Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, when we were having a look at the life of David last year, we left David having received this very great promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7. But tonight we're going to actually see David move to the very pinnacle of his life as king. The story of David has come so far after he'd come into the kingship at the age of about 30. Through a fairly tumultuous period as he successively and slowly got more and more support, and first he was king over Judah and then over all of Israel, and his great ambition through all of that period, not only in uniting Israel, was to bring God into the midst of the nation, and his desire above all was to build a house for God. And that's where chapter 7 begins, as you know, verse 1 of chapter 7. Came to pass when the king sat in his house and Yahweh had given him rest round about from all his enemies, that it was then, prompted by Deuteronomy chapter 12, that he desired, thinking it was the right time, he desired to build a house for God. He had repelled the Philistines, and those who were immediately in the land had actually been put down, and so there was rest from round about, from his enemy. In his face, it actually, the Hebrew actually means. But God then went on to say, David, you're not building me a house, I'm going to build you a house. And in the process of doing that, in verse 9 of chapter 7, he says, and I was with thee whithersoever thou wentest, and have cut off thine enemies out of thy sight in thy face. And I have made thee a great name, like unto the great men that are in the earth. So already he's saying, I've done some of this for you, David. But he goes on in verse 10, and I will now in the future, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time. So God had promised now that something was yet going to happen in the future, and David was not just not sloppily listening to these words that came from Nathan. He grabbed hold of every single word and thought about them from that time forward, no doubt, because it meant so much to him. And then in verse 11, and since the time that commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies. You know, that phrase in the middle of caused and caused to rest from all thine enemies. In the RSV, and in fact most other many other translations, it's put into the future again. I will give you rest from all your enemies. So God says, I'm going to put you in a place, David. I'm going to put my people Israel in a place of their own, and they're not going to be afflicted. And then I'm going to give you rest from all your enemies. And then in verse 12 and 13, then he will build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now we know how that was to play out, brothers and sisters. But imagine this from David's point of view. He's listening to these words. He doesn't know exactly how God's going to outwork the next 2,000 years of history. He believes that God is going to, that he is going to have a son. He believes in the resurrection. He believes that God is going to establish this son on his throne, and he's going to reign forever. He believes all of that. But he's thinking about how this is all going to happen now and what he can do. He's not just going to sit down and put his feet up and hope that God's going to suddenly drop things into his lap, or he's just going to wait till he dies and then God's going to resurrect him. That's not the sort of man this is. And so chapter 8 starts, brothers and sisters, immediately after he's received this, immediately after he's received that promise, after this, chapter 8 verse 1 says, after this, it came to pass that David smote the Philistines. Now, the Philistines had already been in a certain degree of submission to a degree. But it says he smote them and subdued them. And it never says that about the earlier battles that he had with them. And he took Methag Ammah out of the hand of the Philistines. Well, you know, I think that we don't read of any provocation here on the part of the Philistines apart from the normal, that is, that they were always agitating to some degree, but we don't hear they gathered their great forces up into the territory of Israel. We don't actually read that. David goes down and deals with them. Because David was thinking about the promises. The precondition of the house being able to be built was that God said they'll have rest from all their enemies, they'll be in a place of their own, and they'll dwell safely. And David knew that those Philistines were confounded nuisances just down on the border. They were just seething and agitating, and they would be back at some point. So he moved, prompted by what God had said in 2 Samuel chapter 7, I believe. You know, and he moves in these this series of battles and so on that we read in chapter 8 of 2 Samuel. He moves north, south, east and west. He takes on the enemies of Israel around. And to him it seemed as though it was God endorsing the establishment of the extension of those borders. Because Israel, in fact, was not safe within the Abrahamic borders. Remember what 2 Samuel had said? I'm going to give them a place of their own and they're going to move no more. Do you know what that would have meant to David? David knew exactly what God had said to Abraham. He knew that the territory exactly that had been promised to Abraham, that was the place. And God promised that they were going to be there and never move. And he looked around and he saw Philistines still down in some of the territory promised to Abraham. And he looked over the other side and he saw Moabites and Ammonites and Syrians and Edomites. Because the Abrahamic territory went from the Nile through to the Euphrates. His empire didn't go that far. So David, on the basis of the promise that had been given to him, moves. And what occurs now was going to lay the foundation for the future work of Christ. Because when Christ comes, brethren and sisters, the very first thing he's going to do, he won't be accepted, just like David was not accepted when he was proclaimed king. He won't be accepted by all his own people, as we well know. And there's going to be a process that goes through. The tents of Judah will be saved first, just like they were with David. Then, after some time, the rest of Israel, gathered in from the nations, is going to be gathered to him, and he will be king over them, and then he will subdue his enemies in the process of that. The enemies out wider will be dealt with, and not until there is rest for his people will the house finally be erected. Now, that's actually all foreshadowed here, not only in 2 Samuel 7, but in chapter 8 as well, because of what David actually did here. It's quite an amazing story, really. And, you know, sometimes we just read straight over all these details of some of these wars, and you think, what on earth are all these wars here for? Why do we need to know about all of this? It's a very, very good question, brothers and sisters. And I hope at least we can get some keys to the answer to that. We're not going to have time to deal with all of it tonight, but at least we might be able to have some keys so that when we look at a chapter like this, we can expand and let our mind drift across it. Well, there were seven really military campaigns. Look, there were other... David came back and dealt with the Philistines after this, we're told a little later. But it appears that there is one section here in 2 Samuel that's discreet in its own right that was prompted by the giving of the promises. And seven waves of campaigns went out, and they were quite massive. You know, we read just in a couple of verses about this battle, and he went and did over the Philistines. Can you imagine what that was actually like for David to go to war against the Philistines? I mean, none of us have really experienced that in its severity, and certainly not close up what that war might have been like. But David moved out in all these directions. Now, I'm wondering if I've got... Don't know, there's another one in here. This, that, that's better. You can see from the center of the land, he moves out against the Philistines, out against Moab, down to Edom, up right up to the north here. So in basically all directions he moves in some of these campaigns. Well, actually, let's come to the first one in verse 1, because we're going to have to move fairly quickly tonight. We just read verse 1, but let's just read it again. It came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them and took Metheg Ammah. Well, the Philistines, in fact, brothers and sisters, as you probably well appreciate, were Israel's most troublesome and inveterate enemy once they had come anywhere near the land. And in fact, that enmity, interestingly, starts... Does anyone know where that enmity starts with Israel? Enmity with the Philistines and Israel? It's fascinating where it starts.
Back in the days of the believers, they were chapter 5.
Keep going back. Jim? Back in the days of Abraham. It goes right back to the days of Abraham. Do you know that Abraham confronted the enmity of the Philistines? So the enmity of the Philistines starts back at the very foundation of that nation. And how appropriate is that? Here God calls the father of the faithful to build the seed of the woman from here, and right there alongside him is the seed of the serpent. And they never let go. And they were this inveterate, troublesome enemy because they were opposed to everything that God had actually promised to Abraham. So the history there's the history of the Philistines. I'm not going to dwell on any of that, but it's quite incredible, really. You think about some of the battles that happened here through the period of the Judges and then into the early parts of Samuel when the ark was taken, and Samuel defeats the Philistines and Jonathan attacks, and then there's David and Goliath, and then there was numerous other encounters, some positive, some negative, with Israel under Saul, and then finally the Philistines defeat Israel and take their territory and slay Saul and Jonathan in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. The one really interesting thing to notice about all of the wars with the Philistines and Israel, the Philistines were this warlike people who Israel really never, ever could beat on their own. And the only times they ever had a victory over the Philistines were when there was a miraculous intervention by God. It's the only time that Israel ever beat the Philistines. And you can think of some of those under Samson and Samuel and the early battles with David. But, God left the Philistines in the land for a reason. Just come back to Judges for a minute. I don't want to spend too much time here. But in Judges chapter 3, there's a very interesting couple of verses related to the Philistines. Verse 1 of Judges 3. Now, these are the nations which Yahweh left to prove Israel by them, even as many as Israel had not known of the wars of Canaan, because they were not experienced in war. God was going to leave some nations there, and among them were the five lords, verse 3, of the Philistines. And he also left Canaanites and Sidonians and Hivites and so on. He left a few others. But the five lords of the Philistines are the first ones that are actually mentioned there. Verse 4. And they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of Yahweh, which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. That's really interesting, isn't it? Because when King David came into power, the Philistines attacked him with a vengeance. In fact, they came back twice and hit really hard in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And David and his mighty men went out and met them. David was quite worried about meeting the Philistines. And he went down to the hold on one occasion, down to Adullam, to prepare, because they came up in masses. But you know, many of David's mighty men had distinguished themselves in those battles with the Philistines. And you know, not a single person got into David's list of mighty men by just sheer courage and brute force. They got into the list of David's mighty men because they were mighty in faith. And that's why we find so many of them have got exploits to do with the Philistines. Some of those top men, it tells us in the record of Chronicles and of Samuel, that they got into that position because of the incredible victories they'd had against the Philistines, almost single-handed. They were clearly miraculous because of their intense faith. So the victories over the Philistines and over others were really the work of faith. You know, there's a key that we need to notch away here, because these stories are not just about bloodshed and about great victories and how David extended his borders. These wars with the enemies of Israel were spiritually grounded, guided, and directed. And David never went into any of those wars and never won a single one of them without God absolutely in the centre and bringing that victory. So when we stop and think about that, these wars that we read in 2 Samuel 8 and onwards have got an incredible position, because the whole concept and idea of warfare and warring of warfare is taken by the apostles and by Jesus into the New Testament, and it's turned into a metaphor about our struggles against sin, against the seed of the serpent, just like the Philistines were here. So when we find that David takes a strike and subdues the Philistines, he's having a go at the flesh. And the only way they won is because faith soared through in his troops. He was able to inspire that, and because of his own faith that they had this victory. Now, you know, you can actually prove that because of some of the Psalms. And we're going to have a look at a couple of those in a little while. So now for the first time, for a long, long time, the Philistines are subdued, and they never rose again for some considerable time after this. But that's an interesting thing, this metheg amar. In the RV, it's actually translated, not put as a name, it's translated as the bridle of the mother city. And you think the bridle of the mother city of the Philistines, presumably. Well, there is another parallel record of this in 1 Chronicles 18, verse 1. And there, almost exactly the same verse occurs, except for instead of Metheg Amar, it has Gath and her towns. So they've actually translated. It's not actually the same Hebrew, Metheg Amar and Gath and her towns. It's different in the two records, but the record in Chronicles probably clarifies for us what this really meant. David went down there and he took Gath. Can you imagine what the Philistines thought about that? And David would have had all the intelligence about Gath because he lived there, remember? The inside information about how things actually worked and where things were. And he went down and took Gath and her towns out of the hand of the Philistines. And it left a huge impact on the Philistines. They never came back for a long time after this. So this amazing victory that he took here was under the power of God. But then we come to verse 2, and he smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured, he'd put them to death with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought him gifts. Well, I suppose you would, wouldn't you, if that's how you'd been dealt with. The army had been captured, and they're all put in a big long line, and make three lines of it, and these two lines get killed and this line stays alive. You would watch your P's and Q's after that. You would almost certainly bow down and become David's servant and bring gifts if he said. And that's exactly what happened. But you know, Moab previously in Saul's day earlier had actually been a little bit of a problem. Saul had actually fought with Moab. But David had been friendly with the king of Moab, because remember, he sent, when he was in the wilderness and he was afraid of his life and for the life of his family, he sent his parents who were aging there, and they were protected by the king of Moab. So something must have changed here in the rulership and the politics in Moab. Because you can never imagine David actually doing this. Not quite like this. As one writer said, ingratitude was not one of David's failings. But I think David was very, very well versed We know he was. He's a man after God's own heart. And he'd thought long and hard about so many things that had been revealed in the law. And in Deuteronomy chapter 20, that Bruce alluded to on Sunday in the exhortation, just don't turn to it now, we haven't got time, but make a note of Deuteronomy 20 verses 10 to 15, because, and have a look at it at some later stage, but it basically says that if they went to attack not some of those Amorites who were in the land, but outside of the border, they went to attack a nation and they would not submit. That is, they had the chance to submit, but they wouldn't submit. Then they were to kill all the males. That was God's instruction. All the males. So David, far in verse 2, like many commentators have said, David, this almost looks like an inhumane act on the part of David. It's not that. It's actually the opposite. Here is David appearing to have come across the entire army of Moab all at once in one place and lines them up and in mercy keeps alive one third. He severely limited the military capability of the country so they couldn't be a problem to his own people. So he was concerned and interested to maintain the safety of his own people. So he severely curtailed it, but in mercy had shown some mercy to that country, because now at least they had some males who could work the fields and eventually build the nation again. So we come to the third one in verse 3. And David smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. Now, can I just go back here, go back to that map there. Where's Zobah? Well, I've got to find it up here. Here's the river Euphrates up here. And it says David is actually going to recover his border at the river Euphrates. Well, do you know that Israel didn't occupy territory right out to the river Euphrates? What we do know is that Saul, in his time, had fought against Zobah. He had. And we don't know the outcome of that, but there still could have been some control of Israel. And he might have been going up there to strengthen that. But it appears from what we read in this record, Zobah was pretty strong and any control that Saul had done in the past had been well and truly surpassed. So we're talking about right up here. So you can see in here the Lebanese and anti-Lebanese ranges and the Bekaa Valley. Is that how you say it, Rose? Bekaa? In here. That's where where Hadadezer was. So it's in this territory up here. And David was on his way up to secure the borders. In fact, it says to recover. The RSV has to restore. He went to restore his border at the river Euphrates. Well, I think that's an indication that what we were saying before about 2 Samuel 7 is exactly right. David knew the place where God had promise to allow his people to dwell. And he knew it extended right out to the border of the river Euphrates. Genesis 15 tells us that. So in the process of him moving up there, it appears that Hadadezer got a little bit worried. Well, as you would, wouldn't you, if David's fame had gone far and wide. Every battle he ever turned his hand to, he had decisively won against the most horrific enemies against Israel in the past, the Philistines, for example. And so Hadadezer was certainly concerned, very concerned, and he came out with chariots and horsemen and so on. And verse 4 tells us that David took from him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen and 20,000 footmen, and David hoed the horses, all the chariot horses, but reserved of them 400 chariots. Seems a little bit of a strange thing, and we just read that in one verse. So David took 100 chariots, and the Septuagint and a few other versions follow the Septuagint in saying there were 7,000 horsemen, as the Chronicles record says. So whether it was 700 or 7,000 is probably neither here nor there. He took 20,000 footmen, 1,000 chariots. This is in a little verse. This is an amazing battle, and All the more amazing because David's on foot and there are 1,000 iron chariots and at least 700, probably 7,000 horses on top of that, plus infantry on top of that. And they're in an area where you can use chariots, in flat area in the plain, the Bekaa Valley. And Zobah was rich and had great resources and had a very strong army. And to all external appearances, David was absolutely done. This was not a 5-minute wonder, and it wasn't even like that for David. David went in there with the intent to go and recover his border at the River Euphrates according to God's promise. And he meets this enemy along the way, and there's this extended and very, very painful battle that occurs here. You know, you wonder why David, chopped those horses and left some alive. Why did he hack the horses and disable them? And they were valuable. I think the reason he did it is because that's exactly what God did to Egypt's horses when they came through the Red Sea. They found them all dead the next day. So David wasn't going to keep any of them. And Joshua knew that too, because when Joshua went in the land and he came across horses and chariots, he hacked all the horses and burnt all the chariots. And David was going to be no different. Mind you, David did take 100, didn't he? He reserved for him 100 chariots. And I've often wondered why he took them. But it may well have been, brothers and sisters, that he had to get all that spoil back. How was he going to get the spoil back down to the capital city? He took away mountains and mountains of spoil from that region. And it's probably his wisdom and his foresight that left those chariots. You know, we never ever hear of David using chariots in war. He could have had all those 1,000 and another 700 a little later on and any chariots from any other country he went like to go and defeat, and he could have taken them. He could also have made them himself, and he never did. Do you know who had chariots in Israel? Absalom and Adonijah, but not David, because David understood what chariots represented. And you know, as we read there in verse 5, the Syrians, and when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadarezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. Another 22,000 went down as more Syrians poured in. Now, how many did they get? Came in? I mean, he didn't slay the whole lot of them. He slays 22,000 of them. It just sounds so easy. And you know, like, you read down here, well, no wonder Toy, king of Hamath, in verse 9, he he suddenly gets on the right side and sends his son down with presents and wants to get on David's side. Well, as most people would want to do that, you would think. But you come right down to verse 13, and we find that David gave him a name when he turned from smiting the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, being 18,000 men. Almost certainly, I think, that should be the Edomites, not Syrians. It's the Edomites in the Chronicles record. And really, the whole context of that really does demand that. The Septuagint has Edomites, I think. And there is actually only... I read somewhere, there's only a very minor difference in one letter between Syrians and Edomites. And then I saw the Hebrew Edomites and Syrians, and I thought, they're exactly the same. Can't even see the difference. To an untrained Hebrew reader, I couldn't even see the difference till I examined, very carefully the little bumps on the letters. And I finally found a tiny little... So it's possible that that's how this came about, but it's almost certainly meant to be the Edomites. So David actually attacked the Edomites down here, just in one verse, bang, 18,000 down of the Edomites. And you think, goodness me. Well, we know that God is with him. We read that in verse 6, remember? And Yahweh preserved David with us wherever he went. And again in verse 14, Yahweh preserved David with us wherever he went. So, yeah, it's just, God's with David, so down they go. Well, I can tell you, brothers and sisters, that it was nothing like that. These battles took place over a period of something we don't know exactly, but it could be estimated between 8 to 10 years. So what we have here in one or two verses is this amazingly brief record of this account. We do not have the full story, and nor would we want every blow by blow of this. But you know, I think, brothers and sisters, it would be fair to say that this battle, when David engaged with the Syrians from Zobah and from Damascus, and connected with that later on as he fought the Edomites, was one of the most difficult and frightening battles David had ever been involved in his entire military career. And the reason I say that is because we have a window. In fact, we have a number of windows into this period in the Psalms. I'd like to come to Psalm 20 to start with. Because here's a fascinating little exercise in Bible study, trying to determine just in fact what it was like during some of these battles. And I think we have some answers here. If we come to Psalm 20, we notice, first of all, it's the Psalm of David. And it doesn't tell us what the background was. But when we read the psalm, what we identify is this. In verse 1, we know that it was a period of grave crisis. That David himself was away from the sanctuary. That it was clearly set in a time of war, verse 8 tells us. There was a threat of chariots and horses, which is not something that David encountered regularly in his previous battles, because they were mostly the Philistines, who were unable to use chariots and horses because of the terrain. And it was a time of absolutely astonishing victory, verse 6. Now, the whole set of circumstances of this fit David's third campaign perfectly, because David was up against huge odds. And you know, you might say, well, I'm sceptical because it doesn't actually say this was the third campaign. Well, hold your judgment, because this is not the only psalm that will give us information about this period. And you'll see the similarity between this and others. David was up against huge odds. There were two massive armies. One with 1,000 chariots that we know. We don't know how many chariots the other one had. There were 20,000 plus killed in both of those camps. And David was fighting on two fronts at a time. So it stretched his resources completely. You know, there's another dimension to this. While this is all actually happening, something else is happening. Because the superscription to Psalm 60 says, Miktam of David to teach, when he strove with Aram Naharaim and with Aram Zobah, that is the Syrians of Zobah, when Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt 12,000. So it connects that next battle with this one. The battle of the Syrians in Zobah and the battle of the Edomites, which we read further down in the chapter of 2 Samuel chapter 8, are connected. Because what seems to have happened, David is going up to recover his border. And firstly, the Zobah Syrians actually attack with all their chariots. And then the other Syrians come in, and at exactly the same time, the Edomites way down in the south suddenly realize this is the only chance we're going to have. David's out, all his armies up north, we're going to move in, and that's exactly what they did. They moved in across the borders of Israel and affected the people. We know that the people were traumatized by this because of another psalm, not Psalm 60, not Psalm 20, another one again. It's quite fascinating to see just how much information we have. This was a time of extreme anxiety for David. Now, he was going up there on the promise of God, really, in his own mind, that God would actually be with him in this situation. And he confronts this shocking difficulty. First of all, he's confronted by chariots. Then he's confronted by another army coming in from the rear. And then he gets news that he's got to split his army again. And he's got chariots ahead. He's got people all over the place. And now he has to get hold of Joab and send him down to the Edomites. In fact, we know he sent Abishai as well, who was probably the second in command at this time. And he sent them, and he was left alone with whatever part of the army they decided to divide in order for him to deal with the rest of the Syrians and get them under control, because he had to put garrisons everywhere, so he had to put people, soldiers in those. So David here was fighting, was in the midst of a very, very grave, grave crisis. And this is what Psalm 20 looks like. First of all, there's a prayer from the people. That's how it's written. For the king. And then the king's response, and then the rejoicing in victory because God has brought salvation through the king. Let's just have a quick look at this. Yahweh, hear thee in the day of trouble. The name of the God of Jacob, defend thee. Send thee help from the sanctuary and strengthen thee out of Zion. So this is the people praying that God would hear their king in the day of trouble. It's like as if David is writing this as though the whole nation is praying for the venture that's there and asking God to send help out of Zion. You know, the word hear there in verse 1 doesn't just mean hear. It's translated in the RSV answer, and the RV is respond. It's much stronger than just hear. It's a cry to do something because of the it's a day of trouble. You know, that's an understatement of what this day must have been like, brothers and sisters. It would have been traumatic, to say the least. Because in those days, they just didn't put people on transports and just trundle them down. They had to march. Job had to march his army down, and it would take him days through that terrain. And in the meantime, the Edomites are attacking the nation. They've infiltrated houses. They've terrorized people in the nation. And David's conscious of his sheep. Imagine what he's feeling like, so far away and unable to do anything. And so he's writing what the people are praying. May the God of Jacob defend thee. The God of Jacob, what a title. Because it's always used in the sense of delivering the faithful out of trouble that put their trust in him. Well, the real help that he was going to get was really, truly out of the sanctuary. Out of Zion, his true help was going to come. Because, you know, brothers and sisters, this actually illustrates to David's mind that these battles were spiritual battles. He doesn't say, look, send us thunder and blast them off the earth. Just kill this army that's there. Just wipe them out. He doesn't say that. He says, send help from the sanctuary. Why from the sanctuary? Why out of Zion did he want help? Because the only help that David knew he needed was to strengthen his own faith and the faith of those that were there with him. They had to enliven their faith and their courage and wait patiently for God, putting all their trust. You know, it's just what John later taking up this, the fight, that the warfare that we're in. And he said, here is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. The power of faith was greater than the power of flood, of earthquake, of anything else that man could think. The power of faith was greater than all of that. And that's what he's asking for here. And verse 4 says, grant thee according to thine own heart and fulfill thy counsel. The RSV says, that he may grant you all your heart's desire and fulfill all your plans. What were David's plans? Well, he was only up in that region. He'd only engaged these enemies because of the promise that had been given. Because he wanted to put God's name in the earth, and he knew that the enemies had to be subdued before he could build a house for God. So was God going to ignore that? Of course he wasn't. But the people are resting in the integrity and faithfulness of their king. You know, David was an amazing individual and a man after God's own heart. But not only that, one of the most amazing types of Christ. Because so many things that happened to him, the people were saved through his own personal integrity. Through his own personal vision, he took the nation to enormous heights and enabled them to come through battles that no one else could ever have brought them through. It's just like, in a spiritual sense, what our Lord Jesus Christ has done. And verse 5, the climax comes. because the people themselves growing in confidence because of what they see in David. Say, we will rejoice in thy salvation, and in thy name we will set up our banners. Yahweh, fulfill all thy petitions. So the king's victory and the people's salvation are clearly bound together. And the people are looking to David and to the banner that he set up, because it's saying, the banner is saying, God is on our side. Trust him and we can get through this. Reject him and we will be carcasses across the mountains. But then the king's response comes in verse 6. Now no I. You can see the tense has changed. Now no I that Yahweh saves his anointed. In fact, Rotherham, Young Switch, and others put that in the past. Yahweh hath saved his anointed. He will hear him from his holy heaven and the saving strength, with the saving strength of his right hand. You can hear the echoes of other psalms that talk about God saving Christ with his right hand. And so this psalm becomes an intensely personal one for David, about his anxieties and about the victory that he knew God could give. But he knew himself he needed strengthening to be able to lead his people. And it's very easy, isn't it, brothers and sisters, in trouble to say we've just got to trust in God. We've just got to, well, we know that God's arm is strong. But it's a very different thing, isn't it, when it comes to practice and experience. It's a very different thing to know by experience what it really means in trouble to trust in God. And to wait when every sign is saying the very opposite of what you want to see, because that's where David was. He's seeing iron chariots come at him. He's hearing reports all over the place. And everything is going wrong. Everything is going the wrong way. And he's got to lift his mind out of Zion and strengthen the people to wait patiently and put their trust and confidence in God, because he knows that promise has been made. He's an incredible individual. And so verse 7. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of Yahweh our God. You know, this is sort of saying that David is lifting the people, and eventually they've built their confidence again. They don't need to trust in chariots, but they'll remember the name of Yahweh their God. They are brought down and fallen. We are risen and stand upright. Looked everything exactly the opposite of that at one stage. Save Yahweh, let the king hear us when we call. You know, brothers and sisters, you hear all the messianic overtones there, can't you? The salvation of his people tied to the king. God hearing his king. And the people calling out to God to save them through him. Help coming from the sanctuary and rejoicing in the victory that is the king's, not our own. Well, come to Psalm 60, because this is even more amazing. And there are four little passages I want to look at before we look at anything in Psalm 60. One of them is a title that we've already looked at. But in 2 Samuel 8, verse 13, it says that David gave him a name when he returned from smiting the Edomites, it should be, I think, in the Valley of Salt, 18,000 men. Chronicles record says, and moreover, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, slew of the Edomites in the Valley of Salt, 18,000. That actually tells us that Abishai and Joab were there, because we know from the title of Psalm 60 that Joab returned and smote in Edom in the Valley of Salt, 12,000. The numbers are not quite the same there, but it's the same incident. They're going at the same basic time. There may have been more than one battle in the Valley of Salt that accounts for these slightly different numbers. But we know Abishai is there, we know Joab's there, and we know David is there. Three of that were, and yet we know David actually was still up in Syria at one stage. So David hasn't come down straight away. And we're piecing together quite a bit of information just from this. And in 1 Kings 11, which is quite an interesting record, it's a few verses, I've only just picked out one. It says that Joab remained in Edom for 6 months until he had cut off every male in Edom. And it says that Job was there burying the dead. Now, do you think Job was burying Moabites? Or Edomites? I don't. In war, they left them in the open field. It's what the enemy deserved. So if Job is down in Edom, and we're told that he's there for the purpose after the battle of burying the dead, they're his countrymen. So this battle took the lives of some of Israel. That was traumatic for David. Traumatic. Why did it happen? Well, David had dispatched his generals as quickly as he could. They'd come right down to the southern part. The Valley of Salt is right down in the below the Dead Sea. And it had touched the ordinary people. We know it had touched the ordinary people because in Psalm 44, which if we get a chance, we'll have a very quick little look at shortly, we know, written from an entirely different perspective, that the people, the ordinary people, Levites in the country, were affected by this. But Psalm 60 here starts, O God, thou hast cast us off. Thou hast scattered us. Thou hast been displeased. O turn thyself again to us, for thou hast made the earth to tremble. Thou hast broken it. Heal the breaches, for it shaketh. Can you imagine David saying this, brethren and sisters? This is not the words of a man who just marched blasé into a battle and just, oh, come on, let's get him, knock him down, 20,000 here or whatever. This is the words of a man that is under intense pressure. In the extremity of a war that he's just about lost. He thinks he's lost because he thinks that God's even left him. Can you imagine David thinking like that? That's how extreme this was. Thou hast showed thy people hard things. Thou hast made us to drink the wine of astonishment. Oh, this was an incredible tragedy. You would never, never, never have known this, would you, if you'd only read 2 Samuel 8, which is a very brief summary. But we get the human and the spiritual dimension of what these wars were about when we go to the Psalms. David's barely coping from a military point of view with the Syrians, and then he has to cope with the Edomites as well. You know, brothers and sisters, the fascinating thing about this, and it's a question that we hit all the time in our lives, is that God eventually brought great and miraculous victory in Syria and in Edom. So why allow the tragic situation that had brought David to the point where he thought God had cast them off, where he said, it feels like there's an earthquake. Everything's falling around about us. We can't go on. Why did God let the nation feel that anxiety and that trouble and the inadequacy? Why did he let them feel the hard things, brothers and sisters? Well, he let them feel the hard things for exactly the same reason he lets us. You know, we're going to learn a lot about the way God deals with us when we just read the records and the Psalms of David and put them in their context. But notice where David comes through in the middle of all that, though he felt like this. He didn't just throw the towel, he didn't give up. Verse 4, thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee. You can see his mind starting to rise, that it may be displayed because of the truth. In fact, the RSV says, thou hast set up a banner for those that fear thee to rally to it from the bow. This is something that David himself was putting up, so to speak. His own faith was rising and other people were coming and they were believing. So they inspired the nation. And it was his hanging on to the promises and the word that God had revealed. And it's going to be just the same in the future. You know what Isaiah 11 says? And there's going to be an end sign for the people. And to it all the Gentiles will seek. Those who want salvation, who want to find God's hand, will be able to find it. In verse 5, David cries, that thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand and hear me. It's a passionate cry, and back comes God's answer in verses 6 onwards. We find really what the next few verses, verse 6 down to about verse 9, there's an answer that really sees, because David's writing this, he sees himself now superintending the land. He sees God's answered him, and he sees the east and the west. He sees Moab and Shechem and Gilead and Manasseh and Philistia all down. He sees from the north and the south and the west and the east all being controlled by God. He's astride of all these. No, we find, brethren and sisters, when you have a look there, you'll see here's the nations that in this campaign, and we're only up to here. But here we find in Psalm 60 all of these ones mentioned, including Syria, who was involved up here because the Syrians from Damascus jumped in here. And these are not mentioned. That is, Ammon is not mentioned in there because the psalm hasn't even got there. This is actually talking about a period here that's quite local, and that's why we don't read anything about Ammon at this point. But there's they're all mentioned, those very countries and nations that were the centre of what God had been involved in here with David. In verse 9 he says, who can bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? You know, it sounds as though David's saying, who's going to take me right into Edom? Right into Petra, to the strong city, to the rock that no one could ever get in there. We know, brothers and sisters, that David did actually go down there, and he came back as 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel 8 says, he came back having got himself great renown when he came back from the battle of the Edomites. Now, we know this, that David had been up in the north for most of that time and that Joab and Abishai had taken most of the victory. But when David gets down there, something happens. When he comes back, no one remembers what happened in Syria. No one remembers what happened in Edom apart from what happened to David. And it may well have been that David had even penetrated the defences of the high city. Here, just like it says, who will bring me into the strong city? Wilt not thou, O God, which hadst cast us off? Thou, O God, which did not go out with our armies before? Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly. For here it is that shall tread down our enemies. You know, brothers and sisters, when God hears a cry like verse 11 and 12 from anyone in any circumstance in trouble, and it doesn't matter whether our battles are as severe as David's, whenever God hears a cry from a man or woman in trouble, and they cry and say, I haven't got the strength to do this. If I put my trust in man, it won't work. But I believe you can. That's what David went to God and said. Give us help. You're the only one that can do it. As we know from Psalm 50, God will move. He is honored when individuals realize they are incapable of fighting their own battles. And they learn to trust in his time and in his strength. Help us in this hour of crisis. Verse 11 says in the Jerusalem Bible. Well, David's victory is typical here in Edom over the anti-typical Edom. Edom in the Bible stands for another of those inveterate enemies of Israel who always wanted them dealt with, always wanted them wiped off the face of the earth. They're the typical Jew haters. And that had all been foreshadowed long before in Numbers 24 in Balaam's words, when he said, Edom shall be dispossessed and Seir and his enemies shall be dispossessed while Israel does valiantly. You know, that's exactly where David picked up these words. We shall do valiantly. We shall tread down our enemies. He actually picked them up from Balaam's words, Because David's mind has gone back there and seen a precedent in the past. And here's a prophecy that God had made, even in the words, in the mouth of Balaam. And we know that in the future, Christ is going to tread down Edom and take great victory over those who are antitypically the haters of Israel and of his people. I think, brothers and sisters, we might just quickly go to Psalm 44 because we get the other side of the picture here. And another slight slant on this picture. And it's another psalm of this same period. In fact, we can see that it's got the same flavour. It's written, it's a psalm of the sons of Korah, you'll notice. For the sons of Korah, or of the sons of Korah. And it comes from a totally different perspective. Now there's a group of Levites who are guarding the temple and encouraging the people back in the land that are experiencing this same bewilderment because the Edomites have pushed through. Just have a look at verse 9. But thou hast cast us off and put us to shame. He says the same cry is coming here. Verse 23. Awake, why sleepest thou, O Yahweh? Arise, cast us not off forever. These are the people of the land that are feeling this and crying out to God. And in verse 5, through thee we will push down our enemies. Through thy name we will tread them down that rise up against us. So the same spirit is in this group, in the nation. They're experiencing it. They're not out on the battlefield. They're actually in the towns and in the cities. And almost certainly it's centered in this sort of same basic period of time when there was this great, great distress. But They trust in God's reliance in the past. And if you have a look at the first part of the psalm, it's about God's deliverance in the past that leads them to be able to trust. But it all turns in verse 9. But thou hast cast us off and put us to shame. We don't understand, God. We don't understand why this is all happening. We've seen you work in the past. Thou makest to turn back from the enemy, and they that hate us spoil us for themselves. So the enemy must have penetrated right into the nation here, brothers and sisters. Quite amazing, isn't it? And God's providence, he let them. You would have thought that God would not have let them come in. On verse 17, and all this has come upon us. Yet have we not forgotten thee, neither have we dealt falsely in thy covenant. So it's not as if it would come because of their sins. All of this, can you hear the painfulness in that cry? All of this has come upon us, and yet we've not forgotten thee. Though thou hast, verse 18, though thou hast broken us sore. You know, it tells us these battles were not just little minor skirmishes. They entered into the life of individuals. There's a human dimension here, and there's a spiritual significance because they represent our battles, brethren and sisters. They represent our battles in the flesh and the circumstances and the trials that we ourselves endure. Maybe that we haven't forsaken God, just like the Korahites hadn't or David hadn't. And yet trouble came upon them and anxiety and pain. Why? Why all these enemies around? Why this trouble? Well, the answer comes in verse 22. Yea, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. For thy sake we are killed all the day long. It's worth making a note, brothers and sisters, that is cited by Paul in Romans 8. We haven't got time to look at it now, unfortunately. But the context of Romans 8 is about how do we make sense of suffering and trouble. And Paul says, well, all things work together for good to those who love God. But these things can happen even if people are faithful because he's preparing us for the kingdom. And so he was with David. Yea, because of thee, because of our identity with God, because of our attachment to him, because of what that means to be a seed of the woman, we will feel the enmity that inevitably comes. And problems and trouble will arise that we need to deal with. You know, it's an amazing thing, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that the battles that we fight can be just as strong as those that David fought here. He was out on a battlefield and they look terrible and they look very severe and it looks as though there's no way out. And yet, what the Psalms and the historical record are telling us together, and when we look at David, we find this amazing model to deal with our own times of trouble, whether they're through our own foolishness or even at times through our faithfulness. God hasn't cast us off, even though it feels like it. But we must go ahead with that battle. We must lift our minds from the sanctuary. We must draw on the strength that David drew on. You know, brothers and sisters, sometimes some of our battles might actually be as menacing and as dangerous as David's to our spiritual life as his battles were to literal life of his men. And I think what David came to understand is that none of these enemies he could beat alone. They were too strong, they were too numerous, they were too cunning. And the only thing he could do and wanted to do was rest on God. You know, every day we are bombarded by Edom's attack. Edom is the profane, the blasphemous, the arrogant attitude. And we feel the strain of that battle, don't we, brothers and sisters? And sometimes we're touched by the Philistines' intrusion, which is just do what you want. Be yourself. You deserve it. Wallow in the dust. Or sometimes we're influenced by Zobah's trust in human achievement. We can do this ourselves. We can reason ourselves. We can work out everything ourselves. We don't actually need anyone else. With us is an arm of strength, and yet, in all of those things, Paul says, all of that is spiritual wickedness in high places. It's got to be engaged in war. There's a battle to wage. The enemy is relentless. It will give us no rest like they gave David no rest until the time came when God said, enough, I will deal with them. The enemy, all that time, was deceitful and exploited weakness as an opportunity, like in our battles of life, brothers and sisters, it happens too, doesn't it? But we've got to go back to David's Psalms to find the strength that he drew on, because we're fighting a spiritual battle just like he was. His battles were not just military battles, they were spiritual battles. And we've got to find God our strength. We've got to come to find the God of Jacob and to realize that vain is the help of man. And only when we appreciate that we can't save ourselves, brothers and sisters. I mean, in practice, not in theory. In practice, when we actually are taken to the line and we have to admit and cry to God to pull us out of circumstances, only then will he. And he will command deliverances for Jacob. See, that's what Psalm 44 says, verse 4 of Psalm 44. Thou art my king, O God. Command deliverances for Jacob. Well, I think let's go in conclusion to what is a very beautiful verse in Corinthians that sort of, for Paul, I think, summarized the fights of the wars that he was involved in, and he gives us great instruction in 2 Corinthians 10. But he says there, verse 2, I beseech you that I may not be bold when I am present with that confidence whether I think to be bold against some which think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. That's not a new concept. David found that even when fighting the battles that he fought, the weapons of his warfare, though he had a sword in his hand, the real weapons weren't carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds.